Mellon, who is Program Director for the Food and Environment Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Thank you, Karen. Welcome, everyone. I'm really very happy to be here today in California on this beautiful, beautiful afternoon to talk really about the future of agriculture. But before I start talking about the future, or really to set the stage for talking about it, I want to talk a little bit about the past. And let me see. How do we advance this? Okay, all right. I want to talk a little bit about the past. And in particular, I'd like to talk about genetic engineering, which was kind of the new thing, the hot topic 25 years ago in agriculture. As most of you know, genetic engineering is based on the use of molecular techniques to move genes without regard to taxonomic boundaries. That means you can move starfish genes into soybeans, cassava, into corn. It was a radical technology when it was introduced because it did offer the possibility of making combinations, organisms that contain combinations of genes that could be found nowhere else in nature. It's also called transgenic or GM genetic modification. Genetic engineering was used in a number of industries, but I'm going to focus today on GE products for food and agriculture, and primarily that's going to be crops for food and fiber. There are also some plants and animals, most of which have been genetically engineered to produce drugs, there are some other animals, even food animals like fish, on their way. But really, after 25 years, when you talk about GE and agriculture, you're mostly talking about commodity crops. Before I get any further, I want to make sure that you understand the position of the Union of Concerned Scientists on genetic engineering. We are certainly not opposed to genetic engineering on any philosophical basis. We, in fact, welcome the products of genetic engineering whose benefits outweigh their risk. And there certainly are many, I would say, in the drug industry, for example. We value very much the participation of citizens and scientists as participants in the debate. One of our big tenets is that technologies across the board, but particularly this one, involve decisions that need to be made by others than the folks who are involved in creating the technology in universities, in industry, or in government. The rest of us matter and need a voice in the debate. We also take alternatives very seriously. When we're talking about a genetically engineered application, we don't just ask what are the benefits, what are the risks. We always ask, is there another way of doing that? A way that's even easier, preferable in some other way. And finally, because we are the Union of Concerned Scientists, we build all of our advocacy positions on a bedrock of sound science. Okay, let's... thank you. Let's talk a little bit about agricultural biotechnology. 25, it depends on when you start counting, in the early 80s, when this technology burst on the agricultural scene, as I said, it was the new thing. Because the technology was radical, perhaps understandably, it led to a set of really quite extravagant predictions about what it was going to be able to achieve. And I will confess that, you know, as a trained molecular biologist, I was among those in the early days who was willing to listen. I mean, somewhat dazzled by what one thought genetic engineering might do. But looking back, I mean, everything I'm going to talk about is something that I heard, you know, sitting in a darkened room, listening to a presentation by proponents of biotechnology. And in general, what I heard early on was that with the advent of GE, we were going to completely transform farming and the food system. Not incrementally make it better, completely transform it. The big promises, and these, of course, are in addition to making money for the companies that sell the products and perhaps for the farmers increasing their profits, the big societal promises were the following. We were going to have a chemical-free agriculture. No need to add synthetic nitrogen, fertilizers, no need for pesticides or herbicides. A chemical-free agriculture. We were going to have crops fortified against stress, against drought, against salt, against all kinds of stresses, of course, including pests. We were going to have very high-yielding crops. It was going to make the Green Revolution pale in comparison. We were going to have food as medicine. I mean, I remember hearing people talking about, boy, the days of cancer could be numbered if we could just go far enough and fast enough with this technology. And finally, this was going to be the path to alleviating the chronic problems of world hunger. All right, here we are 25 years later. That's a pretty long period of time. The Green Revolution had kind of come and gone had achieved many of its promises within 25 years. Where are we after 25 years of a technology that promised to transform our agriculture? Do we have chemical-free agriculture? In fact, just the opposite. We actually have, as one of the major products of biotechnology, herbicide-tolerant crops engineered to be tolerant to an herbicide that has increased herbicide use, and not only that, shackled agriculture to a dependence on herbicides for the foreseeable future. What about this promise that we wouldn't need industrial fertilizers anymore? That crops could be engineered to fix nitrogen for themselves. They could become, corn could be turned into a leguminous plant. There would be no need to add these exogenous fertilizers. Well, in fact, there are no nitrogen-fixing genetically engineered crops, not on the market, not on the drawing board. They are only I'll say a bit about that in a minute, but they're not out there, and they're not going to be, I would say, in this century. They would require a 20-gene pathway, and currently, after 25 years, there are really no products on the market that express two or more interacting genes. So a 20-gene pathway is just way, way, way beyond possibility. And yet, but the reason I put them in there is that I still hear it. Every now and then, I still hear people peddling the notion that somehow genetic engineering is going to create these crops. So in a way, this promise is a testament to the power of what people want a glitzy technology to deliver. What about stress-tolerant crops? Well, as of right now, there are no stress-tolerant, drought, salt, or other environmental stress-tolerant products on the market. Now, there are many on the drawing boards, and we may see some, but trust me, they have been promised for the last 15 years, and at least so far, they're still like a receding horizon. They're always just a couple of years away. What about high-yielding crops? I'm going to let Dr. Gurian Sherman talk more about this in the next talk. But I want to just point out that when you talk about high yield, you need to think about two kinds of yield. One is intrinsic or potential yield, what crops could yield under the best of all possible conditions. And the other is what I'd call operational yield, increases of yield that might occur if a crop is equipped to or a system is equipped to resist stress or pest tolerance. Now, while there are pest-resistant GE crops, so far there are no commercial genetically engineered crops that exhibit increased intrinsic yield. And that's very important. The green revolution, I mean, that's whatever else it did, and we all know it was it's a mixed picture, but it increased the intrinsic yield of major commodity crops, of major crops important for human nutrition, and it did it dramatically. After 20 years, we've got nothing like that out of genetic engineering. Okay, food is medicine. Again, there's conversations, but there are really no foods engineered to prevent disease that are on the market. Alleviating world hunger. Well, so far, really, genetic engineering cannot compare with the Green Revolution in agricultural accomplishments that are important for people in developing countries or for people who are hungry. Partially, that's because probably the most widely adopted genetically engineered crop is cotton, which is a fiber crop rather than a food crop. In fact, there are only two major applications of genetic engineering crop technology after 25 years. One is to make crops tolerant to an herbicide, as I said, and this is for the most part, but not entirely, Roundup, an herbicide sold by Monsanto. And also there are crops that are genetically engineered to produce their own insecticide, a BT toxin, and thereby help stave off pests. And I'm going to leave the further discussion, as I said, to others. But I think it's important that this is a relatively modest production for a technology that promised to transform agriculture. So, I mean, my contention is that the technology has really been oversold. But my big point is that matters. It is not so what that folks sold a technology as doing more than it would do. As a result of it being oversold, folks in the highest levels of government in this country, in industry, in even in academia, have behaved as if it's a transformational technology, and we've put way too many eggs in that basket. As a result, we've neglected promising solutions to problems. We've devalued conventional breeding, about which I'll say a little more, but which remains a stunningly successful and completely kind of underappreciated technology. And we've also assembled the wrong mix of expertise in our ag universities. Way too many people like me, molecular biologists, way too few agronomists and traditional crop breeders, among others. In general, what we've done developed too limited a toolbox for the big problems that we're facing. If you look at the USDA's research budget, it looks like there's really only going to be one tool in the box, and that's going to be biotech. This is a problem because it's a products-only solution. If you talk about drought, you say, well, look, we need to genetically engineer drought-tolerant plants. Instead of thinking, perhaps, we ought to develop systems, and there are numerous systems that actually enable commodity crops to fend off drought. As a result, we are simply devaluing and not supporting, like we should, organic, sustainable, and systems approaches in agriculture. As an example, I'm going to just say a few words about our research budget. It is skewed way too far in the biotech direction. These are not hard numbers to get, but there's fuzz around the edges. But certainly, on the basis of the USDA's own program, risk assessment program, which is pegged at either 1 or 2% of its total biotech spending, we can estimate that the biotech R&D at the Department of Agriculture from 1992 to 2008 has been something in the area of $3.2 billion. That's something like $188 million per year. And you can compare that to the budget for organic research, which is about $27 million last year, and that is a number that has been available to the organic research community only in recent years. So, I mean, the numbers aren't as important as the kind of imbalance. It isn't that you don't want any money in genomics or biotech, but this kind of an imbalance is inappropriate in light of a technology that really isn't transformational. I just want to say one more word about conventional breeding and how powerful a technology it is, and yet it gets very little sometimes respect, but certainly not the kind of research funding that it should. I want to point out that it is the basis for the agricultural powerhouse that is the U.S. today. It is that we are so good at conventional breeding. It is not that we are so good at biotechnology, and that it has great potential for the future. I mean, we're going to be getting 1 to 2% annual increases in the corn yields for as far as we can see as a result of conventional breeding. That is stunning when you think of how you're going to keep up, say, with a growing world population. We've never applied conventional breeding fully in parts of the world that could use it. And I would just point out that the reason it's so powerful is that you actually select for integrated sets of genes instead of having to assemble them, which is what you kind of have to do with genetic engineering. So I think as a result of this session, certainly all the other ones I've listened to today, people since I've been here, people are beginning to come to the view that we need to retool our agriculture system in a big way, to no longer just focus on productivity, but to focus on productivity plus healthy food, clean air and clean water, reduce climate emissions, reduce use of fossil fuels, among other endpoints. And my point is simply that genetically engineered crops are only a small part of the solution to those big problems at best, and that it's time that we begin to realize what the limited potential that genetic engineering has and begin to treat it not as a transformational technology, but as a kind of modest contributor to enormous problems in the future as we start allocating our public funds. I would just say that the big biotech companies are still promising drought-tolerant plants. As Karen said, there's a big Monsanto has made a push for doubling the yields of corn, soybean, and cotton by 2030, requiring 30% less water, land, and energy. Now, I'm not saying that they're not going to make a contribution to that, but based on the past performance, all of us have a reason to be skeptical that these folks, with their technology alone, are going to be able to accomplish those kinds of goals. It doesn't mean they're not going to accomplish something that we may applaud, but they're not going to be the sole and only solution. So my point is that now is the time to fill out the toolbox, to look at the systems-based, sustainable, powerful technologies that we have neglected in the last 20 years so that we're ready for the future. Thank you.
Do I have to go back out to...